This weekend starts right after this.
As a business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
How to spot depression in your teenager. I'm Mike Gavin, sitting in for Gordon Deal. It's the weekend of March 17th and 18th, St. Patrick's Day, and the day after to recover 2018. Along with Jennifer Kashenka, here's what we'll have for you this hour.
As rates of teenage depression continue to climb, new guidelines are out to help you better spot the disorder in your kids.
With more people depending on tips to make a living wage, servers are forced to weigh where to draw the line with harassing behavior.
President Trump talked about the need for a Space Force branch of the military this week. Is there a need for something like that? And if so, what could it look like?
And forget about cash, jewelry, or electronics. The hot item for thieves to steal is big, heavy, and made of brass.
We spoke with a man in Washington State who has a beloved tuba, 1928. That he restored, and it was in his garage. And he gets home from vacation, and someone's broken into his garage, and they completely ignore the expensive power tools and audio equipment, and they just take his tuba.
That's Wall Street Journal reporter Jennifer Levitz on why tubas are being stolen a lot. That report is later in the hour. Well, we know that the services sector of the economy has grown by leaps and bounds in recent years, and that means more people who depend on tips for a large portion of their income. Increasingly, however, they're having to wrestle with how far they're willing to go to make a living wage. More from this weekend's Jennifer Kashenka.
It's a balancing act that plays out every day in restaurants all across the country. How and when do servers draw the line when a customer goes too far? Katrin Einhorn has written a piece for the New York Times that's especially relevant in this Me Too era and has more. Katrin, what are some of the stories that you've been hearing?
We heard so many stories. You know, you start asking servers about this, and often they don't know where to start. One young woman, a 20-year-old student, told us about a customer who sat down at the window table and just peppered her with questions. Where did she go to school? Where did she live? What did she like to do? Asked for her number, and she tried to laugh it off because that's what she felt like she was supposed to do. And at the end of his meal, he held his tip money in his hand, and he said, "So are you going to give me your number?" Sort of a classic quid pro quo. Others, a server walking up to a group of men who asked her a question who said, this is what they said to her. They said, "We'll give you $30 if you answer this question about your pubic hair." And in these cases, again and again, women who, you know, are often vulnerable financially, who need the money, who may be supporting children, who may be going to school, who have to pay rent, have to weigh, you know, do I put up with this demeaning behavior and get my tip, or do I draw the line and risk losing it?
Katrin, are most of these people women?
Yeah, they are. I mean, the overwhelming, we heard the worst stories from women, and most servers are women. 70% of servers in the United States are women, so it's a highly female workforce. However, men do experience these kinds of harassing behaviors, too, both from men and women.
In a situation where alcohol may be part of this, is that even worse?
Absolutely. That's one of the factors that really kind of erodes boundaries, I think, in a workplace as sort of casual as a restaurant, right? People are drinking, you know, people are on dates, there can be love in the air. And so this sort of adds to just the general ambience of how these kinds of situations can occur.
Katrin, what have servers done and what have restaurant managers done either in support or not supporting their servers?
Well, there's a few things that are sort of going on across the country. There's this restaurant in Oakland, California called Homeroom where they actually have sort of a flagging system they use, a yellow flag if the server is kind of getting the heebie-jeebies about a table, an orange flag if there's an inappropriate comment made, and a red flag if something becomes really overtly sexual and inappropriate, in which case the owner or the manager will kick the person out. There are some restaurants that are actually going no tipping at all. This is a very controversial thing in the restaurant industry right now. But we spoke with servers and managers at no-tipping restaurants who said, you know what, I feel more empowered. I don't feel like I have to put up with this behavior anymore.
Does some of this cross over into a criminal problem if people are being threatened, or your story mentioned customers who pursue employees out into the parking lot? Is it getting more dangerous?
Well, that's something, you know, what we were interested in is how, you know, when we talk about workplace sexual harassment, people usually think about harassment from coworkers or harassment from managers, right? But in certain industries, there's harassment from customers. And it's true, in some cases, that can become quite dangerous. You know, we told the story of someone who was a bartender who was closing up alone at night. A man came in, said he'd been watching her through the window, said he knew she was alone. She ran to the back and called the police, and the man left. Another woman, she was walking out to her car. The customer followed her and blocked her from getting into her car. And thankfully, a coworker happened to walk out, and the man darted away. So, you know, servers, that's not so much about tipping, but that's just about how servers can be in this vulnerable position with regard to men. And some restaurants do put measures in place to support them. For example, you know, they don't want their servers walking out to the parking lot by themselves, so they'll pair up, or they might in some cases have, you know, a male employee accompany the woman out to the car, things like that.
I was going to say the unusual hours that they often work would contribute to this as well.
That's exactly right. Exactly. They're going to their car at 2 in the morning or whatever.
Wow. Eye-opening story from New York Times writer Katrin Einhorn with our own Jennifer Koschenko. It's 12 minutes after the hour now on This Weekend.
If you want the absolute best shirts around, you have to go to CT Shirts. I want you to try them because once you do, you'll never go back to some random shirt off the shelf of a department store. And CT Shirts come in custom sizes, so you're not messing with ill-fitted sleeve lengths or neck sizes. It's time to step up your game and look your best, so I got you a special CT Shirts deal. 3 CT Shirts for $99. CT Shirts use the softest, most exquisite fabrics ever. Work or casual, tie or no tie, tuck or untucked, when you're wearing a CT shirt, you'll look your best. Here's the deal. 1 CT shirt normally costs $100, but right now you get 3 shirts for just $99. That's 60% off. Go to ctshirts.com/deal. And CT Shirts come with free delivery, a 6-month quality guarantee, and free returns. If you hurry, $99 gets you 3 amazing CT shirts. ctshirts.com/deal. That's ctshirts.com/deal.
Gordon taking the week off from hosting duties, though we'll hear from him in just a few moments. I'm Mike Gavin. You know, there are a few things scarier or harder to deal with as a parent than realizing your teenager is depressed. Thankfully, there are some new guidelines that focus on helping better identify teens who may be struggling with depression. More now from the aforementioned Gordon Deal.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal columnist Elizabeth Bernstein. She writes a column called Bonds, critical piece entitled How to Spot Teenage Depression. Start with the numbers first. I'm just blown away sometimes by the amount of diagnoses.
The numbers are huge. Teen depression has been on the rise for at least a decade. And so it was in 2006, 8% of U.S. teens were depressed. Now it's 13%. So this is really a large increase of teens that are getting depressed, and there are reasons why this generation is really under more pressure than others.
And why? In what way?
Well, so one of the main ones is this is the first generation to grow up with social media and smartphones. And so the social media can put a real pressure on teens. They've always felt, you know, the pressure to be popular, but now you can see it in real time. They're gunning for these likes on social media, and they can sort of feel their mood fall and rise based on who liked a post, but also they can see when they've been left out of things right away. If friends or classmates, something's going on, and somebody posted on Facebook, they're not involved. You know, so they really feel this real-time sort of sense of that pressure. That's one thing. Another is this generation is really under some unique, you know, pressures in terms of current events. And the shootings, these school shootings are one of them. They feel quite vulnerable. And again, they can follow along in real time. They can see on Twitter. They can see on their phones what's happening. It's happening right now. Here are peers of theirs, same-age kids, tweeting out that they're under a desk. This is all, like, you know, it's very stressful. stressful for them. And then there's the usual college and the need to succeed, the pressure to succeed, and that has just increased too. It's just harder and harder to get into college, and that also weighs on these kids.
Anybody questioning our competency as parents and helping them manage this?
Well, I do think, and nobody's maybe questioning, you know, saying you're a bad parent, but many, many parents miss this. They think that it's just simply a moodiness, it's a stage. They also, a child may be depressed, and there's such a stigma against mental illness and depression. Both the teens feel it, the parents feel it, nothing's wrong with my kid, buck up, you know, get out there. So they're missing this. 60% of teens who are depressed are not getting treated, and that's just a huge amount, and that's just going to come out later. This, if you're not treating it now, it's going to come out later. You're going to need at some point to treat a depression. It's a very serious illness.
Yeah. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal columnist Elizabeth Bernstein. Talk about teen depression. What should we be looking for? What signs?
Teen depression is the diagnosis for it. It is exactly the same as adult depression. There's a clinical diagnosis. Doctors look for a certain number of symptoms over 2 weeks that exist for 2 weeks. And these are things you might expect. A depressed mood, irritability, a decreased interest or pleasure in activities, you know, change in weight up or down, change in sleep more or less, loss of energy, all of these things, you know, feelings of worthlessness, thoughts of death. And so that's all the same as for adults. You want to look for all of that. But teens may actually present differently as well. So the doctors that I talked to said often teens don't get as melancholy as adults do. They might be very, very irritable. They're not aware of what's happening to them. Adults probably know I'm depressed. So teens get very irritable. That's a big difference.
And then I thought, too, there was an interesting point you made in a breakout in the story about, you know, you got to think ahead a little bit, too. If your kid, say, is an older teen who's heading to college soon, find that therapist or help near campus.
Exactly. So any teen that is suffering from depression, you want to get a therapist on board. You want to maybe start with a pediatrician so they could rule out something physical. You know, you want a psychiatrist if this is really turning into something, you know, if it's a real depression. But also, so now you've got this older child, this teen who's going to go away to college. Don't just send them off to college. If they've had a problem, you want to have that plan in place. And don't rely on them. Help them find that therapist at school. And also, this is really key. Their privacy is protected at school. So if they start to have a serious health issue, that school cannot reach out to you. But you can sign that child can sign a waiver and say, yes, you can reach my parents if you need to. If you've got a child that you're worried about with depression, absolutely make sure that they are signing this waiver so that school can contact you if there's a problem. I can't stress that enough.
Great info from Wall Street Journal columnist Elizabeth Bernstein with our own Gordon Deal. 21 minutes after the hour now on This Weekend. Coming up next, more ways to kill time and spend money at the airport. Well, if you frequently travel abroad, you've no doubt noticed the array of high-end shopping options available to you while you're waiting in the airport for your flight. U.S. airports have been lacking in such amenities, at least until now. More from Wall Street Journal airline columnist Scott McCartney, who says that may be changing, at least at some of the bigger U.S. hubs. Scott, what's trending at the airport?
Well, at big international airports, they're finding they need to look more like big international airports. The rest of the world has really upped its game in terms of shopping. Some airports in, you know, in Singapore or Dubai or London, they're basically shopping malls with gates. And so to attract more international service, to be more hospitable to international travelers, U.S. airports are finding they need to do a lot more. They've done a lot more with food offerings, and now what we're seeing is more duty-free offerings. So Dallas-Fort Worth International has opened a really unique duty-free store. You'll never see a duty-free sign because it's actually open to just about everyone. And you can buy stuff very conveniently and sometimes even cheaply.
And airports have an incentive to do this because, as you write, they get a cut of the revenue.
Yeah, airports get a cut of the revenue. And this is as much about entertainment, though, as revenue. People have a lot of time. You know, they get there, particularly for international flights. You get there 2 hours early. You get through security. And then you got time to kill. And so airport lounges have become much more important. But also in this case, you know, DFW did what a lot of airports have done around the world. They took seating out and they put this duty-free store right at the opening of their largest TSA checkpoint. American Airlines is staging long-haul international flights from the areas around the store. And so basically it's a captive audience where there are a few places to sit, and so you wander, and you wander right up to the cosmetic counter.
And this captive audience is especially something that retailers are looking at because they don't have a lot of captive audiences to market to anymore.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, this is a bit of an antidote to online retailing. This is a place where retailers do have a captive audience. You don't have to go to the shopping mall. You don't have to go to the department store, but you do have to go to the airport when you're traveling. And so in that sense, they're taking advantage of that. Some of this is education in terms of or marketing in terms of offering samples, Hennessy cognac samples and things like that that you wouldn't necessarily try, but you have a generally affluent population. You have a population that is really willing to spend. When you're on vacation, when you're on a business trip and you've been needing off an expense account or whatever, travelers, there's a bit of a different mindset in terms of splurging and spending. And it may be that you need to take some gifts home. It may be that you want to stock up on alcohol or things that you can't get or you can't get cheaply at home. And this is a really convenient way to do it.
You mentioned Dallas-Fort Worth is doing this. What other big airports in the U.S. are looking into this?
There's one under construction in Las Vegas, much the same story. The new international terminal in Los Angeles, or the rebuilt international terminal in Los Angeles, when they redesigned it, they vastly increased the retail space and duty-free space. You're just seeing it more and more, and I think this is, you know, this is the start. This is something that that other airports are going to have to catch up on.
And you write in your column that if you're looking for a good deal, there are some things that are cheaper to buy at the airport, but then again, there are some that aren't.
Yeah, it was interesting. Cosmetics and perfumes, those are very popular items at duty-free stores, and I could kind of see why. Besides the convenience of stocking up on your staples or things like that, the prices were really good, and in a lot of duty-free stores, everything is open to domestic travelers except for cigarettes and alcohol, and many have negotiated sort of tax-free status with the local taxing authorities, so you can stock up tax-free. The prices and the quantities offered are often different. You can they offer things in duty-free stores that you can't get in the regular retail store. And some of the price comparisons I did, they really were cheaper on cosmetics and perfumes.
All right. Thanks, Scott. Wall Street Journal airline columnist Scott McCartney. This business update has been brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. If you want to take your business to the top, take it to a top 10 state for business, Michigan. Contact MichiganBusiness.org today. 30 minutes after the hour now on This Weekend.
FMLA, FLSA, ACA, EEOC. It's harder than ever for businesses to keep up with today's evolving alphabet soup of regulations. What's a company to do? Kronos. With Kronos, you can minimize compliance risk and track HR policies, making sure they are applied consistently and fairly. HR, payroll, talent, and timekeeping in one unified system, all with a proven implementation approach and simplified, transparent pricing. Learn more at kronos.com/compliance. Kronos, workforce innovation that works.
The possibility of a Space Force branch of the military, which President Trump talked about when he visited California, was a hot topic of discussion this week. Some people snickered at the idea because it sounds a lot like the title of a bad sci-fi movie, but it could also be something we'll need to take seriously in the near future. Tech analyst Rob Enderle thinks so, and he joins us now to discuss. Rob, what did you think about when you heard the president talk about a Space Force?
Well, so the problem that the president is trying to address was actually brought up by Congress some time ago, and that's that the Air Force, who now has the responsibility for space, often prioritizes domestic programs, I shouldn't be domestic, but air-based programs over space programs. So fighter jets over satellites, the kinds of things that they need to operate in the regular theater of the atmosphere, they tend to get funding, and that when they get funding, the other programs like satellite funding, either for satellite killers, for hostile satellites, or even for satellite monitoring outer space, get killed as part of that process, and it's not getting the focus that Congress, well, particularly the House of Representatives, thinks it needs, especially with China and Russia both ramping their space programs aggressively. So the idea of a space force would have a group of people that are just focused and funded to protect us from a space-borne threat, which could be anything from a foreign entity with space force or with the space force themselves, or hostile satellites, to an asteroid strike, to the more traditional belief in extraterrestrial an extraterrestrial attack. And realize we also have had a series of somewhat credible UFO sightings going on since 2015 that people haven't been able to explain. They've been hitting the news recently because the videos of those sightings were finally released by the military. So there is a, as they say, there's a big concern that we're not taking space seriously, and this Space Force would at least attempt to address that concern.
You mentioned other countries ramping up their space programs as part of the reason why this is something we should be thinking about. Could the privatization of space travel by Elon Musk and whoever might follow him also mean a greater need for military in space?
Well, certainly with regard to being able to regulate the activities in space, I mean, certainly something as mundane as keeping the level of junk spinning around the globe to a minimum. We're a little bit worried now about the Chinese space platform falling to Earth and maybe not burning up when it re-enters because of a failure there. But we have a significant problem now with regard to old satellites and just junk left over from prior space launches surrounding the globe, and a space force could help regulate or at least attempt to mitigate or eliminate some of that stuff that's up there, and also perhaps help protect some of the private activities that are also going on in space, not only from foreign activity, but from each other.
And as you mentioned, funding being a huge hurdle. I mean, if you think that funding, a ground force like the Army is expensive, doing anything in space is, infinitely more expensive, at least on a sort of a per outing type of basis, right?
Well, certainly with regard to the same level of staffing, it would be. They're really not talking about that level of staffing, though. They're really talking about a relatively small organization to start that would have a focus on just trying to field some of this technology and getting it through and deployed, so that we actually have the protection. Yeah, if we're talking about putting the Army in space, that'd be very expensive, but nobody's really talking about that yet. The problem is, it's not a case of not enough money. It's that the space isn't receiving its due. In other words, it's not getting the funding that Congress thinks it should be receiving from the Air Force. And of course, the Air Force is fighting this tooth and nail because they don't want to lose the authority for space. It's become another one of those DC turf wars that does leave us exposed to anything from a hostile satellite or weapons platform rotating above us to an asteroid strike. And the asteroid strikes, given our belief that the asteroid took out the dinosaurs, is a relatively real risk, a low probability, but we don't have a defense to that right now, and I don't think anybody wants to end up like the dinosaurs.
I think that's a good goal to have. Thanks very much, Rob. That's tech analyst Rob Enderle. Well, by most measures, the overall economy is doing well, with the job market considered to be at full employment and growth in the U.S. continuing at a respectable rate. But still, a significant segment of working Americans are failing to save for retirement, emergencies, and other financial goals. More on that disturbing trend from Mark Hamrick, senior analyst at Bankrate.com, which is out with a new survey this week on our saving habits, or lack thereof. Mark, take us through some of the findings.
By most measures, the U.S. economy is performing fairly well. Growth in the current quarter seems to be a little on the disappointing side right now, but that's probably a conversation left for another day. But amid all these metrics and measures, we're finding a bank rate as a result of a recent survey that many Americans are not saving as much money as they probably should. We found, in fact, that 20% of working Americans tell us that they are not saving any of their income. So that is setting them up for a financial squeeze. I think if you want to find some good news in this survey, and there's plenty of it, I suppose, to be found, three-quarters of working Americans are saving something, but two-thirds of them, in other words, the vast majority, are failing to save more than 10% of their incomes. Bottom line, and it really does get to the bottom line, most Americans could stand to do a better job of making saving money a top priority.
And how does this compare to surveys past about our saving habits?
Well, broadly speaking, we've been making some progress, certainly on the portion of Americans that aren't saving anything. This is just slightly better. But these trends have largely been marching in place, meaning I wouldn't want to go around high-fiving just because of the latest outcome. You know, other surveys we've talked about at Bankrate in the past have found that a surprising large share of the American populace is not putting anything, or I should say has nothing to show for its emergency savings. And so we pose that question as a result of sort of saying, if you had a $1,000 emergency room expense or a $500 car repair, what would your situation be? And almost half the population says we'd have to put that on a credit card or ask for a loan from a family member or friend. So I think this helps to explain kind of perhaps some of the environment that we find ourselves in these days with the sometimes toxicity of the political discourse or lack of civil discourse. It's because many Americans are continuing to struggle. And obviously at Bankrate, we want to basically continue to yell from the highest mountaintop, but basically our mantras, which are, you know, save more money, pay down debt, and live beneath your means, because, you know, we're at a time in this economy where we are seeing some signs of improving wage growth. We obviously are seeing the economy continuing to perform, as we say, you know, pretty well. But we also know that we're 9 years into the economic expansion and bull market. These things do not last forever, and that means you really got to put something away for that rainy day, because at some point down the line, we may be facing an economy that's not performing as well.
And why aren't we saving more? I know you asked respondents that question.
Yeah, absolutely. And this was one of the more interesting findings that we had in the survey. And that was, you know, what are your excuses for not saving more money? And about half basically boil it down to a combination of too many expenses or they blame their jobs. 39% said the expenses are too much. 16% said their job is not good enough. I would say a shocking number, 16% said, just haven't gotten around to it. And 13% blame their debt.
Okay, thanks, Mark. That's Mark Hamrick with Bankrate.com. Coming up on 13 Minutes in front of the hour on This Weekend.
When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for three straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in defense, cybersecurity, mobility, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan among the top 10 states in the country for business. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org.
Well, it's definitely not every day that we bust out the tuba music, but definitely appropriate here. There's a crime wave afoot that would stump Sherlock Holmes, the Hardy Boys, and the Scooby Gang. The prize for these master criminals, tubas. More from this morning's Gordon Deal.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Jennifer Levitz out of the Boston Bureau, and she's written a piece entitled, There's a Tuba Crime Wave Sweeping America. What's going on here? What'd you find?
It seems odd, but a lot of tubas are going missing, and there doesn't seem to be a clear answer why.
So this is not like what a car thief would do and sell a tuba for parts or anything like that, or take it to a pawn shop for cash, or, I don't know, upgrade because you're in a new band or something?
It could be all of the above. It's possible they're selling it for scrap, although they're worth a lot more whole than they would be okay. as scrap. But yeah, there are some theories that they're taking them to for use in other bands because tubas are pretty expensive. Or some people think maybe they're taking them from sort of as trophies from more famous bands. Or they're taking them to try to resell at pawn shops, which turns out to be pretty difficult because it's sort of obvious if a tuba's missing and you try to go into a pawn shop and they can go online and figure out. This kind of matches this, you know, tuba. It's not every day somebody walks in with a nice tuba.
Yeah, right. This is odd, though, because it's big. I mean, it's like 38 pounds, I think you said in the story. It's not like trying to swipe somebody's harmonica. It just fits in your pocket. You got to lug this thing.
Yeah, that's what's so curious. The case that brought this to our attention is in New Orleans. It's the Preservation Hall Jazz Band, very famous band. In that area and around, they have a lot of fans around the country. And there's just been an outpour on social media because the tuba player the other night they were loading stuff in the van, and they were kind of going back and forth and you know, taking some pictures, and they later realized the tuba's missing. And it's this huge tuba, and it's very big, like 4 feet if you set it down up to the top of the horn, you know, 40 pounds or so. Plus, it's got the name of the band in black around the horn, around the bell.
Wow.
So it's a very obvious looking thing. So it was very surprising. You know, what are they going to do with it? Where are they going to try to sell it? So they're really looking for their tuba. Their, you know, police are looking for it. And so we started poking around, and sure enough, these just pop up sort of with some regularity. Somebody's tuba gets lifted.
That's Wall Street Journal reporter Jennifer Levitz talking tubas with Gordon Deal. And this story comes with a happy ending, by the way. After this story ran in the Journal and Jennifer talked to Gordon, the Preservation Hall Jazz Band in New Orleans got its tuba back. The band got a call on their tuba tip line, and their creative director managed to get the instrument back from the person who had taken it. No questions asked. Not bad at all. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Happy St. Patrick's Day weekend to all. Hopefully you are celebrating safely. Well, green beer is fine and all, but if you're looking for something a little tastier this weekend and, like me, are not a fan of corned beef and cabbage, we've got a couple of ideas. Rather, the Washington Post has a couple of ideas, as they've compiled a few of their favorite recipes to help celebrate the holiday. For breakfast, try green pancakes. Now, these aren't Irish at all, but if you're celebrating the holiday more for the green wardrobe than the authenticity, these could be just the ticket. For later on the day, some Irish stew featuring chunks of lamb shoulder accented with loads of potatoes, carrots, leeks, celery, cabbage, and onion. Alongside your stew, maybe you dive into a walnut and cheddar loaf as an alternative to Irish soda bread. The Post says it goes great sliced and served with soup or toasted and slathered with salted butter. And my mouth is watering just thinking about it. For an after-meal drink, try some Irish coffee, featuring heavy cream, coffee, some simple syrup, and yes, a little bit of whiskey. And if you're lucky enough to live somewhere it's warm on St. Patrick's Day, you can make a frozen version too. Happy eating, drinking, and celebrating. For Jennifer Kashenka and Gordon Deal, I'm Mike Gavin. Thanks for joining us this weekend.